Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Zachary Naylor of Chimicles and Tekelis, joined today by Pamela Tekelis, Robert Greiner, and Megan Adams, all of my firm, and also our colleague, Pal Miller, from the Miller Law Firm. Welcome. I have requested 5 minutes for rebuttal today.
Are there any other introductions? Welcome.
The appeal today represents a question of whether or not the complaint of the plaintiff in this case sufficiently alleges a breach of the duty of loyalty and a sale of control. Plaintiff respectfully submits that it does, and that the complaint sets forth a claim that there was an unreasonable process pursued by the board of Activision in selling control to Vivendi. The complaint, the allegations in the complaint, the inferences to be drawn from that complaint paint a picture of insider directors who were interested in getting this particular deal done and a set of outside directors who made that happen for them. And we submit that the Court of Chancery erred in its opinion dismissing the case by giving undue deference to the board in its evaluation of its conduct, and also for dismissing well-pled allegations of disloyal conduct by the board.
Now, let me speak directly to your statement that the outside directors made it happen for, or made it work for, whatever the phraseology was, the two inside directors that were negotiating with Vivendi. What's pleaded in the complaint that supports that the process was flawed in that way?
Sure. I would start by saying that under these circumstances, those outside directors, where they're an interested set of management directors, have an obligation to establish themselves as an independent decision-making body.
They had an independent committee, correct? The committee was made up of independent directors.
That's correct.
Did the officers who were insiders, as you could fairly characterize them, did they do anything more than simply report the status of negotiations to the committee?
The insiders were the decision makers, and they were the sole conduit of information to that would-be independent committee. And so our allegations are that while these were outsiders, they're not dependent on their relationship with Activision or with Mr. Kotick or Mr. Kelly, the insiders, for their well-being or their livelihood, that under the circumstances here, the facts specific to this case, they set up a situation where they were unable to act as an independent decision-making body because Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly were omnipresent at every meeting of that committee and of the board as a whole that had to do with the terms of the transaction. And we pointed the court in our papers to Vice Chancellor Lamb's Freeport Sulfur case. And that was a summary judgment case. And there was a special committee set up there. And the special committee was receiving its information from an interested director, one that had a relationship with the other side of the deal. And there the Vice Chancellor said, as one of his reasons in not granting summary judgment on behalf of the defendants, was that he was concerned that insider director being the conduit of information into the would-be independent board called into question their independence with respect to the transaction.
Well, in that situation, was the insider the only source or conduit of information?
He was not in that situation. There was a banker that was retained solely by the special committee in that case, as I recall, and there was the inside director. However, most of the information in that case did come through conflicted insiders. And I think that's similar here because the only conduit for information about the deal, the negotiations, the terms, what was happening with Vivendi was coming through Mr. Kotick, Mr. Kelly, their fellow management figures, and through the banker, Allen, who had been working with management from the beginning of the transaction. So
does this mean that as a matter of law, the CEO cannot negotiate and be the conduit for information?
It doesn't mean that at all, but when you look at the specific facts here, and I wouldn't want to suggest any sort of per se rule about who could negotiate or when or what would work under certain circumstances, but the situation here where you had directors who were specifically interested in the transaction and the committee members were not adequately fulfilling their duty to be an independent voice, to be a bulwark against that interest, that's where you run afoul of how far a board can go in letting its CEO get out in front without being a check and balance against them.
Well, do the facts as pleaded indicate that the independent directors on the committee were aware that the two insiders, as a part of the negotiation, were talking about what we could fairly characterize as entrenchment, a surviving position with the entity that Vivendi was purchasing?
There was an understanding between Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly and Vivendi from the beginning that they would be the leaders of this combined entity. And during the course of the process, and I don't know if it was at the very beginning or in the middle sometime, but the insiders did become aware that there was going to be a continued employment of Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly in a combined entity.
You mean the independent directors became aware?
The outside directors became aware of that.
Would that, under these circumstances, arguably add value to the deal?
Potentially. It may be one of the things that Vivendi wanted in a transaction was to acquire the management services of the current management of Activision.
Mr. Naylor, let's focusing on the two inside directors, Kotick and Kelly. Does the complaint, is the theory of the breach of duty of loyalty that in this transaction the two insiders obtained something other than what all of the stockholders would have received, and to the detriment or at the expense of the shareholders?
That's part of it. One aspect is that they had specific interests.
Okay. To the extent that that's the theory of the breach of the duty of loyalty, what precisely are you alleging those two directors received at the expense of the shareholders?
Well, I'll take that. The shareholders, we've alleged, have received no control premium here whatsoever. On the other hand, Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly each received payments tied directly to the closing of the transaction. They received those payments in both cash and stock. For example, Mr. Kotick received a grant of 1.25 million shares attached to the closing. Both received acceleration of stock options. Both received 363,000 restricted shares. Both received $5 million on the signing of the deal, and both received
so this doesn't really fit the classic model of breach of duty of loyalty. I mean, you're alleging that these two insiders, I guess aided and abetted by the outsiders, basically abdicated their duty to negotiate for the highest value in exchange for getting for employment agreements. Is that essentially your case?
It's not just for employment agreements. There's those financial terms with which certainly Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly.
Well, employment agreements plus something else.
And also their interest in their professional relationship running this company going forward. I think it's fairly pled that was an important aspect of these transactions to them, but it's not, we haven't alleged solely that the interests alone are what causes a breach here. We've pointed to specific demonstrative actions by the insiders and by the outsiders for that matter that suggest that they were disloyal in the process by attempting to get this deal done rather than trying to maximize value.
Well, the only thing that I'm seeing in the complaint that talks about what really happened during the NCGC meeting is in paragraph 63. And that doesn't look like enough to be more than just an inference of domination by the inside directors of the outside directors. I'm not seeing any facts which indicate that there was dominance that affected the independence and good faith of the board.
Well, one of the aspects that I think is suggests that the outsiders did not act loyally is that they said amongst themselves, and with Kotick and Kelly present, one of the things we need to do here is get a control premium in this transaction. We understand that there's this fixed ratio in place, but we need to secure a control premium. But they walked away from that. And that's one of their, that's an obligation of theirs in a sale of control, is to obtain that. And they walked away from their obligation to do that. So that's not on the outsiders dominating them. That's on the, or on the insiders dominating them. That's on the outsiders' own decision to let it go. So they let it go.
Is that an utter failure? I mean, does that satisfy the utter failure if they tried and did not succeed?
It's not so much that they tried and didn't succeed, it's that they gave up on it completely. So I would think that that would constitute an utter failure. However, I don't think that you necessarily have to get to that language which sounds in good faith with respect to the outsiders here. I think you can, but fundamentally I think they have an independence issue insofar as the only information that's coming to them is coming through the lens of these interested directors. So when they're being presented with a transaction that contemplates a fixed ratio, for example, that's not tied to the actual values of the company, that information is coming through Mr. Kotick, Mr. Kelly, and through Allen. It's not coming from the outside director's independent evaluation of what these two companies are worth or what they stockholders should be receiving in a transaction. That's being funneled through a filter, if you will, of interest. And so it may not be Mr. Kotick standing in the conference room pounding his shoe on the desk saying, you have to go along with this because you just have to, I say so. It's a more subtle form of control and domination, and it's in the process, and it's one that is so intertwined with what the outsiders are doing because they're not getting any kind of independent information, independent analysis, independent counsel.
Well, you would agree, would you not, that the liability of the outside directors, if any, is totally dependent on there being a case for liability of the two interested directors, that is, the insiders.
In to a certain extent,
I mean, if the insiders didn't breach their duty of loyalty, there's no basis to keep the outsiders in the case, is there?
Not entirely, because of this control premium issue that the
now, is that a yes or a no?
It's a no.
No.
It's a no.
In other words, even if the insiders got dismissed from the case, the outsiders can still be kept in on what ground?
Well, I wouldn't say it would be possible to dismiss both the insiders and the outsiders because they're all members of the board and they all agreed to a transaction with no control premium where they undertook an unreasonable process.
Let me stop you there. In a sale of control,
yes.
You know, the fiduciary duty is to get the highest available, reasonably available value. That may or may not include a separately denominated control premium. So putting aside, you know, the issue of control premium, is it your contention, that is, are you pleading that the highest available value was not obtained here?
Yes.
As a result of a deliberate decision on the part of the two insiders not to seek the highest value for self-interested reasons?
Yes. So I would point out with respect to the outsiders that to a certain extent they're here with linked arms with the insiders. I mean, throughout this process, they didn't, with respect to the deal transactions, they didn't go out and get their own banker. They relied on Allen, who had been with management during the secret negotiations with Vivendi from the very start. They never had any kind of direct communication with Vivendi. They never evaluated any alternative. They did not get their own counsel with respect to the deal terms. And in fact, they are still linked hand in hand with respect to the arguments they're making here and their representation here. They've chosen to rise and fall together, and they have done that since the beginning, so it's not a surprise.
The complaint alleges a series of back-and-forth negotiations. Was all of that just a kabuki dance?
Well, you have to recall that a number of those conversations, the back-and-forth, occurred before the board even knew about it. And in fact, by the time the board knew about it, this concept of a fixed ratio was already in place. So once you actually get out of the hands of the insiders alone and the outsiders find out about this, the ratio concept is set.
So that doesn't necessarily follow that the highest reasonably obtainable value would not be achieved. Because they used that concept of negotiation rather than some other concept. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, there's certainly a possibility that under that scenario, you could wind up with the highest value reasonably available.
And why do you say that that didn't happen here?
Well, because we've gone and unpacked the transactions, and we look at, first of all, a committee that wanted to get a control premium, recognized that there was value beyond the ratio, didn't get it. Also, recall the ratio called for Activision to get 52.5% of the combined company and for Vivendi to get 47.5% of the combined company. So that's where the chancellor found that there could be a control premium lurking in that combination, embedded within the exchange. However, that's not how the deal turned out. The next part of the deal was to flip those percentages by allowing Vivendi to take money from one pocket and put it into a company which it was destined to control to acquire additional shares. So if there's value baked into that merger ratio, and even if one accepts that that's maximum value, that's what those two companies are worth relative to one another. And that includes a control premium, and it's the best deal you could have gotten in this transaction. Why then are we giving Vivendi another 63 million shares to flip them into the absolute majority if that transaction, that merger ratio, already reflects a fair and appropriate price?
Vivendi was bringing something more to the table besides cash, weren't they? They were bringing products and expertise in which would be shared in the combined surviving business.
That's right, subject to the whims of Vivendi going forward as a controlling stockholder. So I don't discount that one of the things that a board can consider is the value of the strategic combination. That's something that's on the table. But you have to weigh that, and there's no evidence in the record that there was such a weighing process. So you have to weigh that against the fact that Vivendi is going to be the controlling stockholder. And what the strategic plan may be today may be something completely different tomorrow, because you've lost, as a public stockholder, that unique control right that exists in a public company that doesn't exist in a company that's controlled.
Right, these are independent, disinterested directors, at least the majority are. You haven't pled bad faith in this Revlon change of control context. Why isn't, when you talk about how we weigh to determine both the fairness of the process and the fairness of the price, why don't these independent, disinterested majority of directors get the benefit of the business judgment rule in determining whether or not the ultimate price and the ultimate ratio of stock was fair?
Well, the business judgment rule isn't, I would submit, the starting point in an evaluation of a sale of control. You start with an enhanced scrutiny and the enhanced scrutiny is to look at what did the outside directors do along this process, and was it reasonable? Was it the product of adequate decision making? And if they pass that test, then you go down to a business judgment.
Well, but in the context of a motion to dismiss, we're looking at what's alleged in the complaint that suggests, by directly or by inference, that they failed to meet their duty of loyalty. What is there in the complaint that suggests that precisely?
But we've alleged that they recognized that there was a conflict, that they authorized this board or this committee to take a variety of actions, including negotiate, evaluate alternatives, get separate advice. They didn't do any of that. So that's a first step along this process that suggests that what they're doing is not reasonable in the face of potential interest.
Now, when you say separate advice, they had Allen & Company, correct?
Well, management had Allen & Company.
The corporation had Allen & Company.
Well, Allen & Company was retained by management. They were working with management throughout the secret negotiations. Their payment was contingent on a close of the transaction. And when push came to shove, when the board finally got a valuation of Activision, and we're talking about right before they approved the agreement with Vivendi, management came in and said to Allen & Company, we don't want you to use the most current projections in valuing this company. We want you to use more conservative projections in your DCF analysis. The reason for that, it's to lower the value of Activision relative to the value of Vivendi Games, to make that ratio, the one that was set way back when in May, we're talking about November when this valuation is happening, the goal is to make that ratio look fair.
Can you give me the percentages? If you're asking for us to find that the chancellor erred in not applying enhanced scrutiny, what percentage of the deal was cash and what was stock?
It was almost entirely stock, because the Vivendi Games put in its unit. Blizzard received 47.5% of the to-be-combined company. Then Vivendi put in a cash payment to obtain another 5% of the combined company, and that's what tipped Vivendi over to the control position. So it's a classic change in control, a change of control in that sense, that you had a publicly traded company which is now subject to a controlling stockholder.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
If the court has nothing else for me at this time, I will.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice Steele, Madam Justice Berger, Mr. Justice Jacobs, Mr. Justice Ridgely, and Madam Justice Johnston. May it please the court. My name is Ed Micheletti from Skadden, Arp, Slate, Mar, and Flom, here on behalf of Activision and the Activision Board of Directors. Respectfully, we ask this court to affirm Chancellor Chandler's decision below. His 50-page written decision to dismiss this case was well-founded and well-reasoned. He applied the standards he was supposed to apply on a motion to dismiss involving a change of control transaction, starting with Revlon and going right all the way through to this court's most recent unanimous decision in Lyondell. What did the court conclude about the allegations in this complaint using those standards? A number of things that I think are helpful here and warrant dismissal. The court considered that this was a deal between two public independent companies entered into at arm's length. There was a disinterested and independent board that engaged a nine-month process, met collectively or as a committee a dozen times over that time period, received advice from multiple deal advisors, Allen & Company and McKinsey & Company are the two most notable, received a fairness opinion, was active and informed about Activision's value and Vivendi's value, and unanimously approved on December 1st, 2007, deal that had a 25% premium at the $27.50 price, a premium that appellant concedes at paragraph 26 existed on the day the deal was announced, paragraph 26 of the complaint, and explicitly concedes it was 25% at other spots in the record, B6, appendix site B6 and B136 being the most notable. The deal was tested by a seven-month post-merger market check between the time the deal was announced in December 2007 and the time the stockholders voted on it in July 2008. No alternative bidder emerged during that period, and I think this is a critical fact. Appellants are not raising any challenge whatsoever to the deal protection provisions in this merger. So there is no barrier for another alternative bidder to emerge, and none did. Moreover, stockholders overwhelmingly voted to approve this transaction to the tune of 96% of those who voted based on full disclosure after the nearly 300-page proxy was blessed by the chancellor after a full preliminary injunction hearing and a full preliminary injunction record. Now, what did the court make of all these facts? Well, as alleged, the court held that there was no duty of loyalty claim stated, especially one based on domination and control. He found that to be entirely conclusory. He also squarely rejected the claim that Mr. Kotick and Kelly were conflicted because of amended employment agreements. Those agreements were approved not by Vivendi, as appellant has suggested, but by the Independent Compensation Committee of Activision's board. Vivendi had nothing to do with it. The attempt to tie Mr. Kotick and Kelly to Vivendi through those agreements is illusory, and the appellant retracted that statement below in open court at the motion to dismiss hearing based on questioning by the chancellor himself. They concede that Vivendi did not approve those agreements.
You agree that enhanced judicial scrutiny must be employed when there's change of control?
We agree that this is a Revlon case.
And does
Mr.
that
Justice.
Become before yes. or after a analysis of whether there's a breach of fiduciary duty?
I think this court's decision in Malpede sets the standard the best, and that's the one the chancellor below relied on. Even when enhanced scrutiny applies, such as in the Revlon context, and Malpede was a Revlon case, the plaintiff still has an obligation to plead facts at the motion at the outset that state a claim either for the duty of care or the duty of loyalty. There is no separate Revlon duty, so those are the duties that the court has to focus on when determining whether a claim has been pled. So here it's either care or loyalty, and appellant concedes that the Section 102b7 provision in Activision's charter, which bars money damages for breaches of the duty of care, is properly before this court on this motion. And the chancellor acknowledged that as well in his ruling. And as the appellant also conceded, if they don't plead specific facts that allege a breach of the duty of loyalty, this case should be dismissed. A duty of care claim does not cut it in light of the Section 102b7 provision in Activision's charter. They concede that. They can't state a claim only principled on care. It has to be based on loyalty, and their claims on loyalty are without merit. I hope that answers your question.
So it's your position you can start by looking at loyalty before you get to analyzing the transaction itself in terms of its fairness and the existence of a control premium?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not my position, although we've adopted it. It's the standard that's been set forth by this court in Malpede. That's the standard we rely on. It couldn't be clearer. Even if Revlon applies, a plaintiff must plead facts that state either the breach of the duty of loyalty or duty of care at this stage to get past a motion to dismiss. On both accounts, we would contend that they haven't done either. They haven't stated a care claim or a loyalty claim. But most importantly, in light of the Section 102b7 provision, they haven't stated a loyalty claim, and the case should be dismissed on that basis, just like in Malpede.
So there really are only two ways that the plaintiffs can establish for pleading purposes the breach of the duty of loyalty, either by pleading sufficient facts to show bad faith, or a conflict of interest that caused them to advantage themselves at the expense of the shareholders in this transaction. On that map, where are we? What is the other side's theory, as you understand it, and where is the defect in terms of the breach of the duty of loyalty allegation?
Yes, Mr. Justice Jacobs. Let me see if I can answer that for you. I think I'd start with the Chancellor's decision itself. He expressly reviews, addresses, applies the right standards, and rejects every one of their loyalty theories against Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly and against the outside board and against the six outside board members. I think the place to start is with Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly. Their claim against them is based on the fact that they were negotiating for amended employment agreements at roughly the same time the deal process was taking place. Their entire theory about Mr. Kotick and Kelly emanates from that event, and it's based on a misrepresentation about what they allege in the complaint. They allege in the complaint, paragraphs 91, 92, and 95, those are the paragraphs that address this issue, that those agreements were negotiated and approved by the independent board members on Activision's compensation committee. During briefing below and during oral argument below, they suggested to the chancellor that, in fact, it was Vivendi who had approved those agreements and negotiated those agreements. And based on questioning by the chancellor himself, they withdrew that because and conceded that they did not allege that in their complaint. And, in fact, they did not allege that in their complaint. And on a motion to dismiss, that's where we are, where we're supposed to look, where the court's supposed to look, and they don't state a claim in that regard. And there's other reasons as well, Your Honor, why they don't state a claim. But I maybe have a question.
Well, one thing that comes to mind, if I understand the appellant's position, is that this was an independent committee charged with the negotiation. They had the authority to hire their own investment banker and their own counsel. They failed to do so. They let two, what they would characterize as interested directors, insiders, negotiate the deal for a price in a surviving company where they would have continued employment. And the suggestion is that the way in which they negotiated was more a focus on ensuring their continued employment than it was in maximizing the price for the shares. They go off on this idea that there should be somehow a separately identifiable control premium, perhaps. But put that aside for a moment. The suggestion, as I read it, is the complaint says because they let the insiders run the show when they were charged with running it, they, in effect, while being disinterested and independent, failed to carry out their obligations in good faith. They arguably had a conscious disregard of their responsibility to vigorously carry on the negotiations independently on their own, to hire the help that they needed to determine whether the process and the price were fair, and in that way they breached their fiduciary duty. Can that be supported by the facts alleged in this complaint?
No, Your Honor. I think that theory that appellant is arguing is entirely conclusory and doesn't stand up based on the specific facts that they do allege in the complaint. That's not just my assessment. That was the chancellor's assessment as well as he went through what was alleged. There's a few aspects to your Honor's question. Let me see if I can just walk through them in turn. As for Mr. Kotick and Kelly, even putting aside the amended employment agreement issue, there were other points that the chancellor relied on to dismiss the conflict claim against them. And again, the appellant's entire loyalty theory emanates out from those two directors, so it's important to focus on them, I think, first. Number one, the court focused in on the fact that the appellant did not allege anything to suggest that their jobs were in jeopardy or that they had some improper entrenchment motive to favor a deal with Vivendi. They're not on both sides of the deal. They're not alleged to be on both sides of the deal.
Change in control bonuses and the $10 million cash payable on signing? Doesn't that put them on both sides of the transaction?
No, Your Honor. Those negotiations took place exclusively within Activision, between the Activision Compensation Committee and Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly. In fact, they were separate and apart from the deal negotiation themselves. Appellant alleges in paragraph 45 of the complaint that the Compensation Committee was separately represented for that purpose by Sherman and Sterling. Elsewhere in the record at A205 to 210, it's noted that the Compensation Committee also had Frederick Cook as a compensation advisor for that purpose, and Mr. Kotick and Kelly were separately represented by Wachtell Lipton. So, respectfully, the two were isolated. The negotiation on the employment terms occurred within Activision. The deal obviously occurred between Activision and Vivendi. Back to your question, Your Honor. In addition to not alleging an entrenchment motive, the Chancellor also noted that Mr. Kotick and Kelly collectively owned 7.5% of the outstanding equity at the time of the deal, which directly aligned their interests with those of all other stockholders. They had a powerful incentive to seek out the best price reasonably available. In addition, in rejecting the conflict claim, they noted, or the Chancellor noted, that appellant had alleged in paragraph 95, I believe it is, 91, 92, or 95, that they had actually taken concessions in the deal. The best example of that is Mr. Kelly in the negotiations actually had his salary cut in half. They also waived a number of unquantified, at least in the complaint, unvested stock options and the value associated with that. And the appellants never allege anything to suggest that either what was received in the new agreements were material to their overall wealth, and they never really do a fair comparison between what they received in their new agreement and what they gave up. So there's an absence of information.
Can there ever be a circumstance where, even if it's all done internally, that a director can become interested by a bonus payable at closing? Instead of $5 million, what if it was $50 million, $500 million, $5 billion? Do those numbers make a difference?
Your Honor, perhaps. Those are facts that did not occur in this situation. There are a number of cases, and it's a well-settled area of Delaware law, that change of control agreements generally aren't evidence of disloyalty, especially as here if they're neutral. So I respectfully can't say what happens at certain levels that weren't in existence here in this case or alleged to be in existence at this case. It may or may not state a claim in some other scenario, but that wasn't the case here. So all of those reasons, Your Honor, the claims against Mr. Kotick and Mr. Kelly are without merit. Now, to focus on the outside directors, they don't appear to be raising a conscious disregard claim.
Let me stop you there for a minute just to make sure I have your argument firmly in hand. You're saying, number one, there's no loyalty claim against Kotick and Kelly because to the extent it's premised on they're bargaining away the entitlement of the shareholders for a control premium, and that's directly contradicted by paragraph 26 in the complaint, which alleges that there was a control premium. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Number two, separate benefits that were negotiated for by Kotick and Kelly in the form of these employment agreements and the signing or the closing bonuses were all done internally within Activision, and there are no facts that show that there was any agreement between Kotick, Kelly, and Vivendi, or a wink of the eye or a nod of the head, that there would be any kind of understanding between them.
Yes, Your Honor, and the Chancellor concluded that as well, yes.
Okay, that's your position.
No connection between Vivendi or Activision, or Mr. Kotick and Kelly, excuse me, about those employment agreements. That's okay. Right. They were negotiated and approved by the Activision Compensation.
Did I miss anything? Are there any other reasons why there are no...
The other reasons were the lack of an allegation of an entrenchment motive on the part of Mr. Kotick and Kelly. Their jobs were not alleged to be in jeopardy. They didn't need to do a deal with Vivendi to keep their jobs. Number two, they collectively owned 7.5% of the outstanding equity at the time of the deal, directly aligning their interests with those of other stockholders. And three, they took some concessions in the negotiations with the compensation committee.
Let me see if I understand correctly. Are you saying that the change in control bonuses and the additional $10 million cash payable upon signing and closing were part of the employment agreements?
Yes. Yes, Madam Justice, that's correct.
Right.
As to the outside directors, the only theory of disloyalty brought against them on appeal is one of domination and control. And the Chancellor below rejected that as entirely conclusory. It's based on a single sentence in their complaint. That's where it shows up, paragraph 56 of the complaint. And respectfully, Your Honor, that single sentence is the same sentence that appeared in Aronson versus Lewis. It's the same shorthand shibboleth that this court rejected 20 years ago in Aronson. It should be rejected here as well. The only ostensible basis for even making that claim is they allege that the outside board members, the independent board members on the committee permitted Mr. Kotick and Kelly to attend certain of the meetings. Not all of them, but certain of them. And respectfully, that's not evidence of domination and control. And beyond that, the specific factual allegations that are pled in the complaint about the board's process over the nine-month period belie any notion of domination and control. And just to go through them quickly, the plaintiff alleges that the board or pre-existing committee of directors of the board met 12 times separately over the course of 9 months. The plaintiff alleges that the board had Allen & Company for financial advice, and they had McKinsey & Company who performed due diligence on Vivendi and its business units and prepared a detailed report that Allen & Company ended up using as part of its analysis. The appellant alleges that the board received a fairness opinion from Allen & Company. Plaintiff alleges that the board received at two critical periods downloads of valuation information of both Activision and Vivendi. Paragraph 25 On the day the board met the full board met to decide to approve the deal, Allen & Company provides the board with a full download of valuation information about Activision at the time. Paragraph 45 alleges that 4 months after the decision to approve the deal took place in December, in April 2008, the full board meets again and gets another download of information from Allen & Company about the up-to-date valuation information from about both Activision and Vivendi. So this was an informed board about value. The appellant alleges that the board was informed about management's early contacts with Vivendi. This idea that there was some sort of secret process here, it's not what they allege in the complaint. Paragraph 49 makes it clear that Allen, at the very first meeting the board, at the full board met to discuss the deal with, potential deal with Vivendi was April 2007. They received a full download of all management's contacts prior to that time. That's alleged in paragraph 49. Management's contacts and discussions with Vivendi prior to that time, paragraph 49. And beyond that, the idea that this was a secret process or it was the board was kept in the dark or stockholders was kept in the dark, not alleged and not raised below. It's raised on appeal for the first time.
To be fair, I don't read the appellant's position to say that the independent directors were kept in the dark. I understand their position to be that their sole sources of information that they would use to determine whether or not they ultimately achieved a fair price through a fair process in this change of control was disseminated to them by two inside directors. The investment banker was hired by management, they say. They were authorized to have their own investment banker and their own attorneys, but instead they chose to use the corporation's attorney. The suggestion is that under these circumstances, how can they be carrying out their fiduciary duties in good faith? They're consciously disregarding steps they could have taken to assure a control premium, a better price overall, and a fairer process. They allowed it all to be channeled through these two interested directors and through the corporation's investment banker and attorneys. Now, is there any case law that suggests that a process that's characterized as they would characterize it is somehow inherently flawed? Because they didn't hire their own investment banker, because they didn't hire their own lawyer, because they didn't keep the insiders out of the committee meetings from time to time, and they relied on the insiders as their conduit for information from Vivendi. Any case law that says that's a conscious disregard for the board's duties?
No.
Duties.
No, Your Honor, no. They don't cite any case to suggest that in the circumstance that we have here where you have an eight-member board, six of whom are outside board members, that they don't have a single case to suggest that the way the board proceeded, as alleged in the complaint, as the chancellor reviewed it in his opinion below, suggests a corrupt process, a disloyal process, most importantly. Not a disloyal process and not even a grossly negligent process. This board proceeded the way it should have proceeded, as alleged. And the case that comes to mind is the case that the appellant at the last oral argument before this court highlighted as good authority in this area, and that's the Mone decision by former Vice Chancellor Lamb. In that case, there was an allegation similar to the allegation made here about Mr. Kotick and Kelly. There it was the CEO who stood to make change of control payments based on amendments to those agreements that occurred during the same time as the negotiation process with the other side. Revlon applied in that situation. And the court there held that it was not disloyal, grossly negligent, or otherwise a breach of fiduciary duty for the board to rely on management in that circumstance to conduct negotiations. The appellants try to distinguish Mone from here by suggesting that, well, here the outside board members were dominated in control. And, Your Honor, respectfully, as the chancellor held below, there's the specific factual allegations that are in the complaint utterly belie the notion that this board was dominating the control. Again, it was a nine-month process. The board members met 12 times. The full board approved the transaction in December. There was never a conflict arose, and they haven't alleged anything that suggests a conflict arose either at the board level or with any of the advisors. So there was never a reason for anybody to go hire separate advisors. There was never a conflict that arose. They don't identify one. So hopefully that answers Your Honor's question.
Wasn't it alleged that Allen & Company was was told by the two insiders to use lower values so for the second valuation so that the terms would still look okay?
Right. A couple things about that, Madam Justice. Number one, I think at the end of the day, that type of argument that they make, which is premised on a conclusory notion that somehow the whole process was corrupt or disloyal, including Allen and Company, they don't state any reason to believe that that's true. So what you're left with is a quibble about a financial advisor's inputs, which doesn't rise to the level of a breach of the duty of loyalty in any sense. At most, perhaps, it might be some form of negligence, but we don't even think it gets there. Paragraph 79 of the complaint makes it clear that Vivendi received the same information about Activision's projections at the time that this was alleged to have been, an issue. Vivendi received the same information that Wall Street did. Paragraph 79 makes that clear. So I think that addresses that. I see that I'm close to out of time. I did want to say a couple things about control premium and about the best value reasonably available, if I could. But we've already I've already mentioned that they concede the 25% premium at various spots in the record. The fixed exchange ratio argument, the idea that the fixed exchange ratio was set early in the process without regard to the actual value of the companies involved in the deal, it doesn't stand up based on what's alleged in the complaint. Paragraph 73 specifically says that Allen and Company, relying on McKinsey, set a range of $8 billion to $9.5 billion for Vivendi Games. Vivendi Games under the fixed exchange ratio was valued at $8.1 billion. So the board, looking at that, said to themselves, at a $27.50 price and at $8.1 billion, we might have just obtained an asset worth $1.4 billion more than we paid for it. There was a lot of value there. On best value reasonably available, I'll be very quick on this. They don't allege anything about a higher or better offer ever emerging throughout any of this time. They don't allege that Vivendi could have or would have paid more money. They're not even alleging a challenge to the deal protection provisions in the deal. There was no barrier whatsoever to a higher deal emerging in the 7 months between the time the deal was signed up and the time the stockholders voted on it. This is not a situation like Revlon or QVC where the charge was bitter favoritism and improper deal protection measures blocking a higher deal from emerging. That's not even what they're arguing here. This court has every reason to conclude, as the Chancellor did, that this was the best value reasonably available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
If I understand the defendant's argument, it's essentially that anything in our complaint that suggests that there was a good process here is not conclusory, and everything that suggests that this was not an independent or fair process is conclusory. I respectfully submit that we've put in a complaint that tells a full story, and we're not trying to hide anything that the board did do, and we're trying to show the things that they didn't do. So to the extent that Mr. Micheletti suggests that our entire story is one of faithfulness and loyalty, it's certainly not. We wouldn't be here if that was what we had actually pled in our complaint. A word about the outside directors and their process here. There are a lot of badges of loyalty that were attached to this transaction. There's a banker. There's a fairness committee. There's a would-be independent committee. They're the things that you expect to see in a transaction where an outside set of directors is doing what they're supposed to do to ensure that there's an independent bulwark against management figures who have some sort of an interest that skews from what the regular public stockholders feel or face in the transaction. But what we've alleged is that when you peel away each of those badges here, you look at the banker. Yeah, there was a banker, but they were the ones that were working with management. They took directions from management. They imagined an extra $1 billion of value for Vivendi Games at a time when the fixed ratio could no longer be supported because of Activision's astronomic growth. So peel away that badge of loyalty. Look at the badge of loyalty of an independent committee. This is an independent committee that is supposed to be reviewing what's going on with the negotiations. No one here is saying that the CEO can't be out negotiating the terms, but an independent committee shouldn't be relying exclusively on their CEO for all information, especially when they've recognized up front that, you know what, there may be a conflict here. The CEO may have interests that diverge here. Maybe we should get another banker. Maybe we should get counsel. So peel away that badge of loyalty that suggests that there's a reasonable process here. And I submit when you read our complaint in full and you're able to peel away those layers and you're not just pulling a sentence here and a sentence there as the defendants would have you do and say, look, here, they met 12 times. Yeah, they met 12 times, but every time the subject was the terms of the transaction, Mr. Kotick, Mr. Kelly, and Alan were there for the entire duration of the meeting as the sole source of information.
Weren't they the best source of information?
There was certainly no check on their information. They were the ones conducting the negotiations. They were the ones who had to give the information, but what the committee didn't have was anyone to say, well, wait a second, does that make sense? Does that jive? And that's where I think...
So you're saying someone else should have been there?
That would have helped in these circumstances.
Well, I thought that was the role of the disinterested independent directors to ask the questions.
But what we've alleged is that they didn't get where they needed to be here because they asked the question up front. They said, we need to get a control premium, and then they walked away from that. So one thing that we've said is that they've set themselves out in the proxy as having made several independent decisions, as steering the process. But then if you go back and look at the minutes of those meetings, of what these independent decisions and steering the process happened, the minutes don't reflect what the proxy says. So there's backfilling and there's rewriting of history of whether or not this process was truly independent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.